This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Tonight, we break new ground on this program as you're hearing the same exact music that opened the program last week, the opening minutes of the nearly 70-minute work for piano and 40 one-bit speakers called Surface Image, performed by my guest from last week's program, pianist Vicky Chow. Then, on Friday night, you heard her perform it as recorded last month at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. Tonight, we'll close the loop and chat with the composer of the work, Tristan Parrish. Mr. Parrish considers himself a composer and visual artist. In fact, our interview took place in the basement of the Bitforms Gallery on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, where an exhibition is going on right now of my guest's drawings. I'll give details at the end of this program. These drawings are all created with the same processes that he uses to create sound recordings, i.e. music. He forged a rather unique path using the very simplest of electronically produced sounds, that which can be generated with just one-bit technology. He has already created a fascinating array of works using these sounds, either the sounds alone or, in the case of the work for Vicky, paired with a live musician or musicians and acoustic instruments. He is constantly thinking of how machines and man can create together, and he even composed a one-bit symphony which you can purchase and which then you plug in and activate and listen to using a pair of headphones so that the work is being generated right there in the CD jewel box. We'll hear about that a little bit later. Today with Tristan Parrish. Last Friday night, our listeners heard Vicky Chow perform at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, the Edward T. Cohn Concert Series. The work you wrote for her, Surface Image, those that heard it on the radio heard the interplay between Vicky playing the piano and the 41-bit speakers that were around her, which is how the work is laid out. Those that went to the performance saw Vicky's great virtuosity, but also these speakers, which are on uniform stands, are all very interestingly laid out. They have no covers on them, so the cones move. So it was this kind of living organism going on stage. You and I are chatting in the basement of Bitform Gallery, which upstairs you're about to open an exhibition of your visual artwork. Which leads to the question, which I didn't do this when I introduced you. Composer, but what are you actually? I ask that with the greatest open-mindedness, because how do you consider yourself?
I guess I say composer and visual artist. It's not very... it's just those two terms together. Yeah, no, some of my work is composed music, right, and some of it is visual art, and they really do fall in these categories. I think, if anything, I'm attracted to kind of more traditional frames of thinking about things. So the piece for Vicky, it's a composition. It's through composed. Mm-hmm. She has a score. There are speakers on stage, but it's still an hour-long piece of music that's more or less the same every time you hear it. And the same is true of the artwork that's here. It's mostly works on paper, which are drawings. They're made by machine, but ultimately, on some level, they're no different than any other drawing. It's about making a mark on a piece of paper. Yeah, so I guess in a way, it's like, if I'm thinking about things like computation and these kind of processes and about randomness and theoretical mathematics and stuff like that, these ideas get output into one medium or another. So similar ideas might be driving the piece for Vicky and this visual artworks, but at the end of the day, it's a piece of music or a drawing or video work or whatever.
So your mind actually can use paths and say, this idea would work better here in the sound realm, and this work would better in the visual realm. And
yeah, and I mean,
that's pretty interesting, actually.
Well, I think, I mean, if you think about a medium, yeah, or a genre or something, it's really, I have this kind of mathematical definition. I think of like a piece of music is like time-based work for sound coming out of like one or more speakers, for instance, or sound sources, musicians on stage. And a drawing is like a non-time-based work in two dimensions. A sculpture is a non-time-based work in three dimensions, mm-hmm, whereas dance is time-based, three-dimensional with performers. And so each of these kind of like different media has this set of parameters that defines it, very specific for me. I'm very kind of cut and dry like that. And then the ideas that then inhabit those dimensions might be very similar. Like with the drawings, it's about how randomness fills space, and these simple computational processes explore space through randomness. And the title of the exhibition is Noise Patterns, which refers to my Last Circuit album. It's this piece of music that is composed randomness. It's exactly the same kind of starting seed, except that in one frame of reference, it's composed visually and working with surface. And in music, it's composed sequentially and working with timbre and what's being output through the two speakers in your headphones. So they kind of map differently, and two-dimensional information is fundamentally different than one-dimensional information. Like, I don't think that they can be readily mixed, but you can have an idea that gets explored in a different set of parameters like that.
Here is more music from my guest today, Tristan Parrish, and once again composed for a past Cadenza guest, the New Music cellist Mario Roberts. This work for cello and 6-channel 1-bit electronics is called Formations, and we'll hear the closing minutes as performed by Mario Roberts.
think our listeners might be listening to you saying, this is very different from all the composers. I mean, so it's hard to get deep information on you. So I'm curious, growing up, was it a musical household? How did you come across the visual? And also, just because we'll talk about as we go, fascination with machines and how that worked. I mean, what led you to this point?
Yeah, well, the way I grew up with it was with my father, who built a painting machine before I was born.
Oh, wow, okay.
He grew up in communist Yugoslavia and was sort of an inventor himself, like covertly building radios and stuff so that they could tune into Italian broadcasts that, you know, were, you know, the outside world, right? Outside of that kind of communist center. And he came to New York and then he built this painting machine and he was sort of exploring video, like the idea of he was exploring making painting in the same way as video is made, which is a scan line, especially back then in the like 60s and 70s. And you had these old televisions that made images with a scan line. He wanted to bring that into the world of painting, essentially, and use the scan line as his brushstroke. And so he was doing this before I was born. I grew up with this. It was kind of all very like normal to make art with a machine. And at the same time, my parents listened to a lot of Philip Glass, especially his early works. And the idea of like making music based on very simple processes that sort of unfold and over time, and you get to witness that unfolding, that's a very sort of machinic idea itself. It's you're just letting this set of instructions play out. And we also saw a lot of minimalist art, like Saul LeWitt and Michael Heiser and all these folks when I was growing up. So like this is very much part of how I see art and what I even how I define it, maybe connecting to earlier.
Musically, you trained. I mean, if you had to make it was a piano, right? You were a pianist, and
neither of my parents were musical at all.
Yeah, I was gonna say there's no music in what you just outlined. There's a lot of fascinating stuff, but there's no except for going to the Glass concerts and hearing that music early on in its stages.
Yeah, and I think if anything, like I mean, so Philip Glass, his early works especially are really austere and minimal, and like a basic 2-on-3 polyrhythm I found absolutely fascinating when I was a kid. And I think that was like connected to my interest in math. But it was also really beautiful music. And I think that part of that beauty is that he just had a like a lyricism and just like a sense of beauty in music. And it was very natural to him, even in this austere context. But then the other side of what made those pieces so beautiful was the kind of more conceptual poetry to them. It's like there's a profound kind of beauty, like witnessing these simple processes play out. And to me, that's sort of like the beauty of nature or like the beauty of physics when you understand how gravity works or something, that like it's beautiful in its elegance, but it's also then beautiful like watching it happen, like anything from just understanding the trajectory of a rock that's thrown through the air or something, being connected to the motion of the planets or whatever. Like these are things that we find to be kind of poetic, beautiful things like in our culture. And I think that his music and Steve Reich and these folks like tapped into that, and the minimalist and visual art too, like they were doing things that we could understand them, and because you can understand it, you can really live in the process as it's happening, and you can like understand the changes, and so it's like always including the listener in that.
Well, it's interesting that you came to that music on a purely like aesthetic level rather than an academic level, saying here's what they're doing, let's rip it apart type of thing.
Well, polyrhythms, I don't know, I think like my uncle is a musician. I guess he is the musician of the family. He was one who showed me the polyrhythms in classes, like piano works especially. Yeah. And that's sort of an academic approach, I think. It's like an aesthetic, it's like a layman approach at least.
Yeah.
Layman academic. Like.
But it wasn't coming to, here's what they're doing against the processes of academia, you know, the surrealist music and all that kind of process.
Not at all.
They were, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't even know about that until later.
Yeah.
This fascination with one-bit technology and live instruments can be playful in the hands of my guest, composer Tristan Perich. Here he is as performer, recorded live at Joe's Pub in New York City at the 2011 Sonic Festival, Sounds of a New Century, a festival featuring works of composers 40 or younger. It is a work for three toy pianos and three one-bit tones from 2009. Its title I cannot pronounce, and my guest, its composer, conceded he could not either. It is, all in lowercase letters, QS, 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 QQ, 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 QQ.
I don't know if this is your last works or just as far as the electronics go, you've kind of limited yourself, if you want to say that, and you're working with 1-bit technology. I just said 41-bit speakers. Mm-hmm. I know you've done this before, so you should have to. Can you, for our audience in the best layman terms, just describe 1-bit technology, and then because it's producing sound, maybe give some examples of the sounds they produce, what we've heard that in our environment.
Sure. Oh, yeah, I mean, you've basically heard 1-bit sound in anything like your old digital watch beeping or in a microwave beep or something. It's like 1-bit sound is the simplest way you can create sound electronically.
Right.
It's basically just turning a signal on and off, on and off. And those are ones and zeros, basically, in code. And so, yeah, the 1-bit in 1-bit sound means that the sound wave at any moment in time is either just a 1 or a 0. It's one binary value, true or false, 1 or 0, on or off. And in computers, these ones and zeros are stored as on and off voltage levels. And basically, like, if you connect that to a speaker, the speaker magnet turns on and off as the signal turns on and off. And so the speaker membrane moves in and out. And if you do that on, off at an audible frequency, like 440 times per second, then you get a 440 hertz tone. Much the same way as, like, when you turn on a lawnmower or something, you hear it like rev up and, it makes this drone pitch. Like if you do anything in an audible frequency, you hear a pitch. And so this is just a very basic realization of that. And I fell in love with the sound because I guess mathematically it was interesting because there's no extra translation there. It was just like the ones and zeros that were output from the code were the waveform. There wasn't any extra digital analog converter you'd have in a normal like hi-fi sound. Or medium-fi or whatever. Even like early Nintendo systems and stuff, like that was all 8-bit sound. And when you have 8 bits, you can have 256 values, as opposed to like CD-quality sound, which is 16-bit, and you have these very smooth approximations with 2 to the 16th possibilities. When you go down to just 256, it starts to get a little stair-steppy, and you kind of hear this electronic grit to the sound. And when you go down to 1-bit, then it's very raw. So, yeah, and I loved it, just the sound of it, too.
Like, is that the reason just to say I'm working within these posts here? I'm working within just to see what you could do with it?
Yeah,
it would seem like it would be very limiting, but it looks like it kind of freed you up to say, this is what I'm not going to do.
Yeah, I think, so all of those things, like, I tend to not think about it in terms of limiting because, at least for me, it was like discovering a new instrument.
Right.
It became more about, like, the expressiveness of the sound as opposed to what it can't do. And I think that that's similar to if someone's playing the violin, they don't think about how the violin can't sound like a trumpet. They're thinking about what you can express with the violin. And
right.
So the character of the instrument is what's important there and what is the identity of it. So it was electronic sound, but I wasn't really at all thinking about electronic sound outside of it. It was just its own sound for me. And when I was doing this, I had a lot of friends who were performing in the chiptunes music scene, which are like people who make music, usually kind of like dance-oriented music with like Game Boys and stuff, like repurposing that technology. And it was a very fresh, exciting sound palette for these musicians. And so I was like the 1-bit guy. And so there was something kind of fun for me, I guess, about that. That was kind of like the posts bounding it in. But no, I just kept going with it though because of the sort of conceptual side of it. And then the fact that I really liked the sound. I started out with just like an album stereo electronic sound, and then I brought it onto the stage with other instruments.
Right.
And it was compelling for me having the speakers on stage making sound alongside these acoustic instruments, which is what my background was,
like,
and as a composer. And there was something to explore there, that those sounds meshed at all, and that like there was something meaningful to having like the speakers on stage with the musicians and making these duets or something.
So the percussive tone nature of 1-bit technology are here combined with true percussion instruments, in this case two sets of crotales, or ancient cymbals, along with 6-channel 1-bit electronics, in a work titled Observations, performed by the Meehan Perkins Percussion Duo, music by my guest today, Tristan Parrish. Thank you.
You then, I don't think if they're available anymore, but you created a one-bit symphony.
Mm-hmm.
So you might just explain, because this is something that actually, when you got it, you created it. That's pretty close to...
What do you mean by...
Well, I mean, you purchased it,
mm-hmm.
and you made it happen. I'm saying it wasn't pre-recorded. You were actually...
Right.
Hooking everything. What's the right way to say this?
I wrote all the code. I designed the circuit and everything, so...
It's on a chip.
Yeah.
And you would activate it. So write the rest of our terminology, because I haven't actually had one in my hands.
Right.
So
it's an album I put out as a circuit. Like, I got into doing the one-bit sound stuff through building circuits.
Right.
And so at some point, I realized that this could be the format for releasing this music, as the circuit itself instead of recording it. Yeah, that led to this album where there's a little battery, a little chip that generates the sound, an on-off switch, a volume knob, and a headphone jack. So you plug your headphones in and you flick the on-off switch on, and all of the wiring is laid out very visual, like clearly. So the hope is that when people turn it on, they kind of understand that they're connecting the battery to the chip and setting the code in motion, and that's what they then hear. Because it's a code that's synthesizing the sound. It's not playing a recording. So there's kind of like this performance element to it.
In a weird way, it's like a live performance.
Yeah.
In a very different way of thinking about it. But you're creating it. It's not just in the CD player, push a button, and information's being read. You actually have to make the connections to make it happen.
Yeah, I think like all computation is live. It's funny when you use computation to play back a recording, because... the playback of the recording is live, but the recording itself is an artifact.
Right.
And one thing you can do with computation, which is one of the first things you learn when you're programming, is about the infinite loop, and where you just say, like, where there's only one instruction, and it just says loop. And essentially that's implying that this would run forever.
Right.
And so something that can run forever is inherently outside of any possible recording, because a recording has to have been started in the past and stopped in the past and then put on a CD or whatever and distributed. So like there's something outside of recording that something live is, because when you're in a concert on some level, this is really funny. I saw a performance years ago at a party where this guy did this kind of like performance artwork. It's sort of like he did a dance kind of motion. It was very subtle, and he just kept doing it, and time just went on, and 45 minutes went by, and the beat was just repeating the whole time too. And I remember my friend and I thinking, like, what if we're in this sort of time loop? Like, what if, like, this thing could literally go on forever until we walk out of the room, and then life will kind of, the time will resume its normal course of events? Because that, you inherently don't know what's going to happen next in the real world, whereas with a recording, it's sort of, like, already been defined.
Is there anybody else doing what you're doing, I mean, right now that you know of? I mean, in the way that you're doing it?
I mean, I don't listen to nearly as much as I should. There are a lot of electronic music composers who I think are exploring the sounds that machines make.
Yeah.
And that's actually the music that I connect to most these days, is like people thinking about the nature of machines and what that means sonically. I just find more of a resonance myself with that kind of approach, I think.
My guest, Tristan Perich's One-Bit Symphony, is an electronic composition in 5 movements on a single microchip housed in a CD jewel case. One-Bit Symphony is not a recording in the traditional sense. It literally performs its music live when turned on, a complete electronic circuit programmed by the composer and assembled by hand plays the music through a headphone jack mounted into the case itself. Here are a set of excerpts from the piece.
as you keep going on this path, mm-hmm. are there goals? Are there destiny? Are you thinking, I'm going to carry this through? Are you thinking it's going to change at some point and I'll be interested in this? I mean, you've got this whole connection upstairs with the visual going mm-hmm. on. I mean, is this just where you're at and you're not thinking of what's down the road? Or
yeah, well, I think that it's kind of like what I was saying earlier about mapping an idea into a medium or something. So, like, One Bit Symphony, which, by the way, is still available.
It is still available.
It's on our, my wife and I started a record label called Physical Editions, and it's on that as well. And her work actually thinks about similar ideas, but coming more from a sculptural side as opposed to, a numbers side. And we end up thinking about similar things, like the sort of physical side of electronic sound.
Okay.
But, One Bit Symphony is all tonal content, and same with Surface Image, the piece with Vicky. It's tones, essentially, pitches, which are fixed frequencies, right? And when I started working with the drawing machine, which is actually right when I was first exploring One Bit Sound, from the beginning that was exploring randomness in space. But it was also like a probabilistic randomness, and if you have a 0% probability of changing direction of moving randomly, then it moves in a straight line. So order is kind of like, in that sense, like one end of the spectrum of randomness, and there's kind of like this linear sort of transition between them. So I was doing the pitched stuff, which is kind of like orderly content mm-hmm. composed, and then that led then to thinking about randomness in my music, which became noise patterns. So there are no tones in it. It's working entirely with texture and rhythm and white noise, essentially. And so then that became an album. And so the way I like to approach things is taking one of these parameters and maybe inverting it, and then that leads to a whole new body of work. Yeah. Like, for instance, that goes back to these drawings in the exhibition. So I have some pretty different things planned, you'll see.
Which brings us back to Surface Image. But before that, I just want to go briefly into the music itself. Your music, what I've heard, there's structure, but it's pattern-based. There's the repetitions. How do you start creating work? I'm thinking of, like, Surface Image, the length. It's a very banal question, but our listeners might think, how do you know when it's ending? When, where's the arc in the piece? Is there an arc in the piece? How do you even begin it? I mean, how do you work that way?
Yeah, it's super hard, actually.
I know there's hard questions to answer, but
yeah,
other composers have very traditional ways of, you know, I get this idea and boom, I go with it.
Yeah, no, my writing process is all over the place. But what I can say is extremely intuitive. Mm-hmm. Like, I have all these very formal structures that I'm working with in the hardware and speakers and the code. But that's just to create a framework for me to be intuitive and just compose. And when I was writing Surface Image, it didn't come out linearly at all. I was writing material and then trying to wade through what it all meant, and I throw out a lot of stuff, and eventually the piece kind of settles into some form, and it's just sort of what feels right. I mean, like, at some point, sometimes writing a piece, I'll be like, I'll have like a certain amount of content, and I'll think like, this just objectively isn't enough. Like, even though this feels like a nice piece, like, it should just be more than this or something. So, you know, eventually it kind of grows to the right length, and then that feels right, and then it's done, I guess. I don't know.
Can you integrate this with voices or a narrative or some kind of theatrical thing? Or is, I mean,
yeah, I'd like to. That's sort of a fundamental next step for me. I do want to do that. The narrative would be like geometry as a narrative, yeah. Like very kind of very abstract. But I like things like, sound like too simple probably, but if you have like a room that's an empty room, then that has a certain shape to it. And then if you put one thing in the room, then it divides the space. And all of a sudden, there's all these relationships that come out of that. And then if you have a second thing in the room, or, you know, if something is moving mm-hmm. and the room is static, like these kinds of geometric relationships, I think, can become a narrative the same way as like different sections of a piece of music that is abstract become a narrative, even though it's definitely not like a plot kind of narrative. But I like that kind of exploration, and I think that when that plays out over time, it's something to hold on to as like a narrative would be. And yeah, totally voices. I really want to do more with voices.
We've talked a lot in this interview about the machine aspect, the electronic aspect, and I think, like with Surface Image, and David put it really well in the broadcast last Friday, when you're there watching it or even listening to it, you don't really need the visual, I guess, but there's a piano and there's these speakers, and there is this kind of duality that you might get like in a standard piano concerto. There's somebody subjugates, somebody dominates, there's this going back and forth. But what you end up as, especially that long time frame, is how they complement each other in one way, but also then you start to think, what is human and what is machine? I mean, it starts to, it's not that it blurs, but it starts to become, does it matter mm-hmm. as you go? And that was a very, very fascinating thing to witness and to hear, so.
Thanks.
I would say, you know, keep going. But I'm not sure where you're, I mean, you're thinking so uniquely, I think, that it's like, I don't know where you're going to go next. I'm sure you do, or you have an idea anyway, but.
Yeah, there's always, I move kind of slowly, in a sense, through these ideas, because I like to have enough time to really sit with a fundamental change. Something I really want to explore is when speakers pop out and then they just stay there. And there's a percussion moment when it pops, but then there's silence as the heat speaker is held in tension. So like it's using the exact same one bit signals, but it's taking the audible frequency part of the tone out. So you just have the start of a sound. Hmm. And so that could become, you know, a few years of exploration or something like that.
Might be an opera in that. You never know.
Yeah.
Like I said, keep going. It's fascinating stuff. I end all my cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. First is a hypothetical, which says if you could chat like we've been doing, but with someone from the past who you never had a chance to chat with. But when I ask that, what's the first name? I mean, when you think about it, you get swamped. But when I just asked that, what was the name that popped into your head?
Well, it connects to the Institute, which is this mathematician, Kurt Gödel.
Oh, okay.
Who was there, and he's really, for me, the most inspiring of those kind of world of mathematics, because he was the one who discovered that mathematics has these inherent limitations, that there kind of always exist these true statements outside of, that can never be proven within a formal system. Yeah. Even if you grow that formal system to include those statements, then there are new ones outside of it. So it's this kind of interesting paradoxical trickiness that's kind of built into the core of mathematics. And he spent time at the Institute, he was friends with Einstein, and really interesting time in mathematics.
Over 16 years of this program, we've had philosophers and some scientists. You're the first one to pick a mathematician. Final question's non-musical. Everybody I interview in Cadenza fills their life with music. You're very busy, not only with your music, but with your installing and, you know, the visual end of it. When you have to get away, step away, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, but just need a respite, what do? Just to get away from either your visual or musical or the combined efforts of what you're doing?
I like to drive, I think. Right. I spend time
on
the road.
For New Yorker, that's odd.
Outside, going on a road trip or something. Yeah. Like, we actually, Leslie and I were both working with Mantra Percussion in a show last weekend in Ohio, and so we got to drive out there with our two kids. And so kids go to sleep in the car, open road, you get to listen and talk, and in this sort of open-ended space. I love that.
Yeah. A road piece. I mean,
actually, I wrote most of Noise Patterns in a car. I found that it was the perfect listening space for me. Like, where it's exaggerated stereo picture, good sound, closed private space. Kind of, it's like good writing.
Justin Parrish, thanks for taking some time.
Thank you, David.
Composer and visual artist Tristan Parrish. You can find out more about him at his website, Tristan, T-R-I-S-T-A-N, Parrish, P-E-R-I-C-H.com. You can purchase the One Bit Symphony at one, as in the number one, onebitsymphony.com. The exhibition of his drawings as part of his Noise Patterns opened yesterday and runs through March 11th at the Bitforms Gallery, 131 Allen Street on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. You can check it out at bitforms, all one word, .com. The work he composed for my guest last week, pianist Vicky Chow, Surface Image, has been recorded on the New Amsterdam label. Check it out at newamrecords.com. And I'll leave you, as I did last week, with the closing minutes of that work, but this from the performance we broadcast last Friday night, recorded last month in Wolfenson Hall on the campus of the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, part of the Edward T. Cohn Concert Series, curated by the artist in residence at the Institute, composer David Lang. The pianist Vicky Chow, the work for piano and 41-bit speakers, music by my guest today, Tristan Parrish. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.
Thank you.